I'm going to open the Public Safety Subcommittee of Ways and Means. Our first item up today is the informational hearing. I'm passing out a draft, which I know members of the audience are here to take a look at to see what has moved and what has not at various levels. I know the rest of the committee isn't here, so my intent is to wait until the rest of the committee gets here, give people time to look at this on the committee. But this is just so people in the audience who are jumping over each other to look at these. This is the working priority list that we worked on last Thursday. This has numbers associated with it. There's a cumulative column, a general fund column, a criminal fines and assessments, and a total funds column. We've attempted to do a cumulative general fund amount. We've also taken the Department of Corrections programs that were constitutionally mandated and spread those so that we put it like with 1145 felons, and then we spread it out with the rest.
Mr. Chair, the exception to that is line number 2, which I have yet to do, and I want to check the assumptions. And we'll do the same thing on the inmate work related.
So Doug is working on that so we can better spread those. I also like to direct the public and the committee's attention to line number 87, which is ranked as an 8 under Department of Corrections. It's highlighted. It's community supervision, parole, and probation. There's $89.5 million in the general fund that is at that number. My intent is to spread that. That's parole, probation, and post-prison supervision. My intent is to spread those according to the crime. So a lot of that number is going to work its way up the list rather than down the list. So just so people are aware, we'll probably have something in the next day or two on this $89.5 million. Because when we release somebody from prison, we want to have them on parole and post-prison supervision. At least that's the chair's intent. And we're going to do that in accordance with how we've broken up the various categories of criminals.
Mr. Chair, you have, as I recall, what, $1.8 billion? Is that what your cutoff is, or do you have a...
The governor's budget funded about $1.8 billion. On the no-judgment budget that was put out just as kind of a working document and generally available to the public, our number was about $1.6 million.
That's as a result of the subsequent forecast following the governor's budget.
Right, that's as a result of the subsequent forecast as well as an ending fund balance and taking out the budget adjustments for merit. Doug and I are estimating remember these were rounded numbers to the nearest 100,000. Doug and I are estimating that we should be, if we were to go to the no judgment budget, it would be somewhere around $1.63 million. So that would get you to line number 80. And that assumes that, you know, there's no cost savings or anything else, but we know the committee's discussed some of the issues. In addition, I added in those items which were highlighted, being line number 5, which is the courts, line number 3, which is the forensics piece at Oregon State Police, as a 39, excuse me, which is a result of Senate Bill 5548.
And 76.
And line number 76, which is the corrections hole the committee's aware of in community corrections funding. We use some plug numbers there. They may be a little higher, a little lower, but we just wanted to have a plug number in there so people were aware of some of those holes that we've already identified as a result of the governor's budget that will have substantial.
Mr. Chair, do you have some, and this may or may not be the spot to discuss it, but are there $0.2 billion worth of efficiencies and other income, other resources that might be yet available?
Well, I think it's unlikely. I think it's unlikely that there's the other resources available in cuts, and I think that that's what I tried to communicate to the committee. And I think the committee is of agreement that, optimistically in efficiencies and other things, we maybe get to $20 million. But beyond that, we have to start cutting programs pretty substantially. So just so people know kind of where we're at. So what I'd like to do is let the committee kind of multitask as we begin the OAA budget to some degree, and we will then drop back to this in the last 15 minutes of the committee hearing to see if people see any errors or things that need to be changed. I tried to take into account the comments that committee members made and make some adjustments, and if there's questions why I didn't make some adjustments, I'm willing to tell people. But this is basically the priority list absent absent the numbers Doug and corrections are going to work on that I'm going to hand over to the co-chairs, at least from a priority standpoint for the budget. Okay.
Mr. Chair, I would just like to thank the agencies because these numbers were cut differently than what traditionally has been the case in some of the agencies, most notably Corrections and I believe Public Defense Services Commission and the courts for that matter. So I'd like to thank the agencies for turning around those numbers rather quickly late last week.
I'd like to thank the agencies and Doug and everyone else who have helped us. You know, Sheila and Robin have put on a lot of work on this thing too. DAS has helped us out to try and get this done. It's a different way of looking at the public safety system, and I think we started out, you know, a little bit this way in terms of what we were doing. So, and I know that Bill and Linda, thanks for helping look over our shoulder on this too. And the governor's office has at least helped me break some of these down, and Phil Lemon at the Criminal Justice Commission. A lot of these people put in a lot of effort, Marla Ray and some other people. So I certainly appreciate it. And so we will come back. We'll drop back to this in the last 15 minutes. So, thanks. We'll let people leave if they need to leave, and then we'll begin the OA. Right now I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 5058. If BAM and OIA want to come to the table, at least to begin with, we're going to open House Bill 5058, which is the Oregon Youth Authority budget. We have Sheila Baker with us from LFO in regard to giving us the general overview. I believe copies of this were delivered to your office. We can begin. Sheila.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee. This is my first time in the subcommittee. Mostly I'm over in human services, so this is a nice change of pace.
I don't know about that.
The chair indicated, you should have gotten a copy of the orientation and background information in your offices last week. I believe there's also a copy at your place today, just in case you weren't able to lay your hands on the other copy. I'll go through very briefly this information just to give you a feel for the agency if you're not familiar with it, and then talk about a couple of the pertinent points to keep in mind as we go through this budget. Then the agency, of course, will make its presentation. Budget and Management Division will give an overview of the governor's budget, and then at the chair's request, there are a couple of I guess you would say customers of the agency here, Multnomah County and Clatsop County representatives, to talk about the budget and how that affects their operations. So I'll start very briefly on the cover memo. There are some pages attached to that. If you go to the third page in, the big print for the elderly people like me on the committee here, it details the statutory charge of the agency, which is to protect the public, hold offenders accountable, and provide opportunities for reform. So there are three core elements of the statutory charge to the agency. I've identified their major programs and services. The one most people think about when they think about the Oregon Youth Authority is, of course, the youth correctional facilities. They also operate youth accountability camps, which is a at a somewhat lower level of close custody, and then they have work, study, and transition camps for youth offenders and youth convicted of adult crimes. That's the part of the budget, as I indicated, that most people think about. The agency also operates significant programming in terms of foster care resources, residential treatment, and other community-based services, so that although almost half their budget is in facilities, about 40% of their budget is in these community programs. And then another significant part of their operations is grants to counties, juvenile crime prevention grants that were provided through 1999 Senate Bill 555 for county basic services, which include things like detention and shelter care. There's local diversion funding, which the agency has been granting to counties for some time, with the intent that these provide community-based services, county-based services that help keep kids out of the Oregon Youth Authority close custody facilities. And then there is a small amount of money, about $3 million, that goes to Multnomah County specifically for gang intervention services. You can see their budget has gone up over the last 10-year period. This is because the state made a conscious choice to establish this as a separate agency, as opposed to where it was primarily housed within the Department of Human Services. They have made a conscious choice to increase funds available for close custody facilities and the community programs as well. So you can see there has been growth in their budget. The governor's budget, however, is down 12% from where this budget ended up at the end of the session in 2001. And the governor's budget does not reflect reductions that would be made specific to this agency for the no-merit freeze that the governor has proposed but hasn't yet been allocated actually to individual agency budgets. That's estimated to be about $3.9 million for this agency, so you will see an additional reduction there as we get into the work session. And the governor's budget also does not reflect some reductions that were made this session in Senate Bill 5548, specifically some area coordinator positions and the Deschutes County pilot project funding, which we'll talk about in a little more detail. But if those are carried forward, that's an additional $2 million reduction to this budget. The next page shows that facilities continues to be the biggest share of the Youth Authority's budget expenditures. It's about $46 million of their total fund budget. Community programs is about 40%. Debt service, which is basically payments on certificates of participation issued to build the regional facilities and do some upgrades at Hillcrest, and provide funding for the juvenile justice information system, that statewide information system. All of that totals about $10.6 million, which is a little less than 5% of their budget. They have a little bit of money, a little bit of general fund for capital improvements, and then administration, which includes maintaining the juvenile justice information system and paying the statewide charges that every agency pays, as well as their central office functions, is about 9.1% of their budget. Then the next slide, or the next page, indicates major factors that influence OYA's costs and expenditures. The juvenile at-risk population, which is basically juveniles in the state ages 15 to 17, that population base, and then looking at arrest rates for juvenile offenses, those combined can drive the number of youth that are committed to the agency for either close custody or community programs. The age 15 to 17 population is expected to grow a little bit over the next few years, averaging over about 2% per year. However, the good news is that arrest rates in 2001 were down to about the lowest rate since 1975. So arrest rates have gone down significantly from where they were in the mid-1990s. One of the other drivers, of course, is that because the Youth Authority is part of the statewide juvenile justice system, it has direct and close linkages with local juvenile departments and local court commitments and sentencing practices clearly influence the number of kids that come to the state and are needed to be provided with services, either, again, close custody or community programs. Special needs of youth committed to OIA continue to be very influential in terms of how the OIA has to structure their programs. As we will see as we work through the agency's material, a large number of youth that are committed to the Youth Authority have diagnosed mental health conditions and need some kind of mental health services. 64% of those in close custody and almost half of those in the community had such diagnosis. And this isn't just this kid is acting out and is hard to control. These are diagnosed mental health conditions. Specialized treatment is a concern, particularly for sex offenders. The number of youth in the close custody system that were sex offenders has continually increased over the past few years. I believe that the agency noted that as of last month, because of some of the youth that were released during the budget reduction phase of the closure of the regional facilities, as of last month, about half of the kids in, or half of the youth in close custody were sex offenders. And so that's a problem in terms of making sure that they get the treatment that they need, and also in terms of how do you move those youth out into appropriate community placements. And clearly a major factor in this budget is the impact of ballot initiatives and legislative policy choices. 1994's Measure 11 affected juvenile lengths of stay, as well as the impact on the adult system for certain crimes and at certain age levels. 1995 Senate Bill 1 was the one that created the Youth Authority as a separate agency and began the push to expand the resources that were available at the state level for juvenile justice issues. The development of the regional facilities, the five regional facilities, followed that in 1996 and 1997, when those facilities were completed. There was a significant ramp up in the state's close custody bed capacity, which had been capped prior to that at about, I believe, 513 beds. And as of the middle of the 0103 biennium, we were at, I believe, over 1,100 beds at one point in time. The facility impact of that, of course, is not just building the facilities. It's also operational, the staffing, health services, food, the programming, if you will, the program services that are made available to the youth. And then, of course, as I mentioned, the debt service on the facilities themselves. And the other policy choice that I noted there was the Juvenile Crime Prevention Initiative, the Senate Bill 555 piece that we had talked about. The juvenile crime grants in this agency's budget, which are separate from but related, closely related to the juvenile crime prevention grants in the Criminal Justice Commission's budget, the total in this budget is about $8 million general fund for 0305, and then the county diversion dollars, which are used at the county level to keep kids from coming to the OIA close custody facilities, is almost $7 million in the governor's budget. So those are policy choices that the legislature has made to continue their partnership with counties to help keep kids from coming to OIA and to provide a continuum of resources. So back to my cover memo just briefly. It shows the budget notes from last session, and the agency will talk about these. There was a budget note relative to how the Multnomah County Gang Intervention Funds would work. There was a budget note on the Deschutes County Delinquent Youth Demonstration Project. There was one regarding the Shelter Services Partnership. There was one that related to the post-custody beds, because the budget did not fully fund the population forecast through the Office of Economic Analysis. And then there were two budget notes related to information systems issues. audit reports, these the agency will also provide information on in their presentation. The major significant issue was with the Deschutes County Delinquent Youth Demonstration Project. There was also interim reports and studies on that issue from two sources, the University of Oregon, and then the Secretary of State audits, and also a report from the University of Oregon on that project. And those reports were presented to the Joint Interim Judiciary Committee during the biennium, so there was considerable discussion about that. I've noted two relevant issues, trends, or special challenges. There are many more, but I think these are the overarching ones that are important. One is that as we're looking at budget reductions in this area, one of the challenges will be to maintain a balance of services, a continuum of services that includes community-based services as well as the close custody placements. As I indicated earlier, when most people think about OYA, they think about the close custody pieces, but it really, these youth are committed to the courts for a variety of reasons and in needing a variety of services. That's something that the state will be challenged to provide as we're looking at reduced funding levels. And then the other bullet I've noted is to continue community partnerships and linkages. This was a special emphasis with Senate Bill 555 in the 99th session. And again, as we're looking at reduced funding levels, it becomes in some ways more difficult to bring and keep people at the table, although it becomes much more important to do that with reduced funding. So that's my brief overview. You'll be getting a lot more information as we go through the next few days.
Thanks, Sheila. Karen, are you going to go, or are we going to have Linda do the wrap?
The schedule is for me to begin. I'm Karen Brazeau, the director of the Youth Authority, and what we have planned is for me to give an overview of the agency, then for Linda Gilbert from DAS to give a summary of that, and for the directors of juvenile departments from Multnomah and Clatsop County to provide you with some information. In the next couple of days, we then have different staff from the Youth Authority scheduled to provide more in-depth information about the closed custody system of the Youth Authority, the field system of the Youth Authority, the administration, and capital parts of the Youth Authority. And feel free to ask any questions during my presentation, although I might suggest, depending on the nature of the questions, that we delay some of that till we get into the other parts of that agenda. We have provided in the appendices for you some of the information that you asked for, and my intent is not to spend a lot of time unless you have specific questions on the audits, the questions that were sent over, any of that kind of information that we provided back to you in writing. But I'm happy to go to those, any one of those documents, and spend some time if you have specific questions.
You can hold those till the end.
Okay.
Unless it hinders our progress in a certain area.
Whatever your pleasure is. And I will try not to be repetitive of any information that was just given to you. So I won't spend a lot of time on page 3 or the beginning of the overview, which is outlines the agency's statutory authority and our mission statement, because your staff, Sheila, provided a very good overview of that, and the agency's beginning in this history of state agencies. We're still relatively new. So if you flip the page and I will provide an overview of how the agency works, but I first wanted just to provide some context, and I've put together a couple of charts. And let me know if you can't hear me if I walk over here. Do I need to talk into the mic?
Probably you can take the mic. I can just take the mic with you. Maybe you can use Representative or Senator Devlin's mic. Senator George
is good at disconnecting.
He might be way back away.
He
does this?
Why don't you
Richard, can you?
How's that? What I'm.
Representative Butler, get to the piano.
Please don't. That it would at least embarrass me. I'm not sure about you. What I'm trying to demonstrate in this chart, and it's information that was certainly not developed by me, but by Del Elliott out of the University of Colorado, and demonstrates the developmental progression of serious violent offenders, and those are the population that I think we're all most concerned with. And typically, I think in the state of Oregon, people are very aware of the young children who we often hear about. Kindergarten teachers say, I could have picked them out from the first day of kindergarten. And in this state, we've had a lot of programs put in place to put prevention efforts in place to prevent those youth or those small children from going on into a lifetime of crime. What hasn't been recognized so much is that the large numbers of adolescents who make up the largest group of serious violent offenders that don't really even show signs of becoming criminals until their early adolescent years. And these are primarily the kids that we see in the youth authority, and they're kids that start acting out in middle school years and start doing drugs, start dropping out of school, really would not have been picked up by their kindergarten teachers, and escalate about in their 16, 17 year time of life. And what we're seeing is that many of those kids in Oregon, largely due to the determinate sentencing laws that we have, once they become engaged in criminal activities, will continue in the criminal justice system and go into Department of Corrections for longer term sentencing rather than kind of grow out of a criminal lifestyle. And so it's really important if we're to turn around these young people, prevent victimization, that our prevention efforts not only do something to address these early onset kids, but also try to intervene, whether it's in the true prevention efforts where they're just starting to engage in experimental drug use or begin to drop out of school, but even with those kids who enter into the juvenile justice system in their county juvenile departments or even enter into the Oregon Youth Authority and try to prevent them from moving into a lifetime of crime. And just to further the chart, there are actually a few adults who don't transition very well into adulthood and turn to crime rather than get jobs. But it's a piece of the trend that really hasn't been very well recognized. And to show you where the Youth Authority fits in, I think, what is a little bit of a complex world of agencies, because kids are complex. Most of the juvenile offenders in the state are dealt with very satisfactorily by their local county juvenile departments. And this should be a relief to everybody. 63.2% of the kids in the state who end up having a referral by the police to their local juvenile department are only seen once, and that's all it takes. And they either get a call to their home or a letter to their home, and they're not seen again. And unfortunately, you don't hear about those kids because they don't come back. But that's really a success story. And your local folks are dealing with those kids very satisfactorily. The sad thing is, we know from the
recidivism study that we have just completed with our county partners, that 9.2% of the kids are responsible for over half of all the new crime. So we know that there's a small number of kids who are doing a large number of crime. And the Youth Authority works with the county juvenile departments to deal with an even smaller number of those kids who tend to be the repeat offenders, often engaging in multiple crimes before they kind of break out of the county's ability, the community's ability to deal with them, and they get committed to the state for probation, out-of-home placement, maybe placement in a youth correctional facility, or just if perhaps convicted in adult court and sent to the Department of Corrections, but are placed into a youth authority facility. So does that make sense to you? I wanted to give you an idea of the proportion of kids that we're talking about, and that using the juvenile justice information system, we know that right now in the state there's about 20,000 juvenile delinquents that are dealt with. The Youth Authority deals with slightly over 2,000 kids at any given time, but during a biennium we'll deal with probably 2.5 times that number of kids, because we have some coming in and others going out. But still, it's a relatively small number of very serious delinquent youth involved in very serious crimes, generally repeat offenders. But the bulk of the kids remain in their communities, and generally, most of them don't ever get in trouble. Those who do get in trouble generally just do it one time.
Senator Devlin. Can you speak towards this microphone, Richard?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. At the bottom of your chart there, it says that 5.8% of juveniles in the age categories 10 through 17 make up the large display that you have here. That would imply that your 9.2% over there is roughly about one-tenth of that. So we're talking about maybe one out of every 190, one out of every 200 children. So 200 young people are the most serious offenders.
That's right. It's a small population. They're very expensive. They cause a lot of damage. They create a lot of victims. They're really hard on themselves. But it's not every kid in the neighborhood.
Or another way to look at that, 94 out of 100 young people in those ages are not causing any problems.
That's a good way to look at it.
Can you keep that chart up, Karen?
Yeah.
Sure.
Representative Hansen.
Two questions. First, trying to sort out that it looks like the 25% between the 63 and the 9, those are repeat offenders that only that you see again, but there's not a real strong pattern.
Generally, those are kids that generally stay at the local level, but they come back, they have more trouble, the counties struggle to serve them, they have programs in place that are working, may not work for all of them. Some of those kids will move into this category.
Okay. The other question, it kind of involves, this is a real snapshot of how serious, what's the range of, are there many serious crimes that are committed by that 63% that you only see once? Is that primarily really minor stuff, or are there kids that you see once but have committed something that really causes a lot of destruction or pain?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hansen, generally the kids who commit the most serious crime imaginable, murder, are the kids who only do it once. But other than that, they're generally fairly low-level crimes. But
we probably don't let them. Anyway.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. And I just want to bring to the committee's attention, I think that this is a good chart, because it does show variety of programs to some degree that,
yes,
are available within the Oregon Youth Authority. And I think that the issue we're going to have as we continue to try and balance the budget is, what's the what's the proper blend, what's the proper optimization of the balance between who we incarcerate, who we put on community supervision, and what kind of, if any, you know, prevention kinds of grants can we afford to put at a local level. And as we move through this piece and Department of Corrections as well, that's something we need to continue to keep on the back of our mind, is, you know, what's the proper blend? Are we warehousing? Are we trying to prevent? Or are we, you know, there's a variety of ways to look, a variety of models to look at.
And Mr. Chair and members of the committee, there are multiple state agencies that assist the counties in dealing with this population of youth. Department of Human Services, you're aware of all the services they provide to families and kids. Commission on Children and Families generally deals with the pre-adjudicated youth, though they're involved in planning for kids 0 to 18. The Oregon State Police are a big part of this system. Department of Corrections, on this end of it, we have kids who are in the legal custody of the Department of Corrections, but 300 are in our physical custody. Criminal Justice Commission provides grants to youth who are primarily in this area of the chart, adjudicated youth through pre-adjudicated youth. And then the Youth Authority, we provide some funding to kids that are kind of from adjudicated on up. And then we're the agency that provides the direct services to these kids at the high end of the chart. So with that, I will move on. Thank you.
Thanks, Karen.
So on page 4, at the top of page 4, we tried to provide just a little schematic of how the system works with these youth from the counties who move into and through the Youth Authority's system. We do have kids that are placed on probation. I want to make clear to the committee that all of the youth who are served by the Youth Authority are placed into the state's custody by the court. And with a few exceptions, most of the youth are removed from their home. So even if they're on probation and not placed in a facility, they've been removed from their home, and the Youth Authority finds alternate out-of-home care for them, either a foster home or some kind of residential or treatment home for them. And often it's because the home is not suitable for them, the family is unable to provide appropriate supervision for the youth, or perhaps the youth's victim is in the home.
Karen, before we begin more into this, can you explain it? Well, maybe you're going to do it here. I'll wait.
Okay. And the youngest age of a child that can be committed to the Youth Authority is 12. The youth must have committed the crime before his or her 18th birthday. They can stay in the Youth Authority's custody until age 25, however.
Can we start back maybe one step before that? And can you let the committee know what the difference between dependency and delinquency are?
Okay.
So that, because we're going to see the terms are on the chart, we're going to see things tossed around a little bit.
Yes, in juvenile court, we'll see children, and the difference generally is between dependency. This is a broad generalization, but the idea is that the dependency situation is because has to do with the best interests of the child, and the court is making a finding because something has happened in that family situation, and the court is trying to make a decision whether or not to how to deal with that family, and the decision must be based on the best interest of the child, whether to remove the child, whether to leave the child in the home, but order the parents to some kind of treatment. In a delinquency situation, the gating issue is because the child has committed an act that
if it had been committed by an adult, would be considered a crime. And so the decision is different based on that turning point. And so while the court still considers that the person before the court is a child, the difference is since 1995 no longer hangs in the balance of what is the best interest of the child. Does that make sense? A little bit? But they still recognize that they're not dealing with adult who can fully make his or her decisions or support him or herself. I mean, this person generally still needs a place to live and supervision and all the support that a child needs. The court can also commit to a youth correctional facility, and we operate the kind of youth correctional facility that you're most familiar with, which would be Hillcrest or McLaren or one of the regionals. We also have youth accountability camp or a transition program. And then youth leave those facilities, generally paroled into a community program where they may go back home, or they may, depending upon the suitability of the home, or they may go again into a residential or foster care situation. In addition to that, the Youth Authority, as I mentioned, also has 300 young people in its physical care who again have committed crimes before the age of 18 but were convicted in adult court. And so they're in the legal custody of Department of Corrections but are in the physical custody of the Youth Authority. And they begin their stay of custody with the Youth Authority and can remain legally with the Youth Authority until their 25th birthday. If they are amenable to treatment and education and are not assaultive or aggressive either to staff or other kids, and we make those determinations on a case-by-case basis between the Youth Authority and the Department of Corrections. And we do send a fair number of youth to Department of Corrections because they choose to not engage in the offerings at the Youth Authority, or they are assaultive or aggressive. Moving on to page 5, this is an overview of the Youth Authority since just prior to 1995, and as Sheila said, prior to 19, to becoming an agency, the Youth Authority had, which wasn't called the Youth Authority, and at that time it was a division of the Department of, I've forgotten even what it was called then, DHR, or Children's Services Division, and there were a total number of 513 beds in the program. And in the middle block, I tried to capture what was or is in statute as the vision of Senate Bill 1, which was primarily a system of graduated sanctions for youth, beginning with regional residential academies, which were never funded, and youth accountability camps. At one time, we had three, and you can see now we're down to one with 50 beds. Youth correctional facilities at one time, well, we built five new ones. We've just closed four. So we're down to three with 625 beds. The work study programs, we still have four. The point of this is we've had various names for this chart. the power and the glory and the dreary. But on the closed custody side of the agency, though our overall bed count still is up 300 beds, for juvenile beds, it actually remains at a pre-Senate Bill 1 level, having come full circle. And on the community side, it's about 25% less than it was before Senate Bill 1, because we never got to the expansion side of the, that side of the agency as was envisioned. Flipping to page 6, the agency's goals and accomplishments. Since the agency began, we have reduced our revocations, and this is how we judge our success. We have no control over who comes in the door. We try to control who comes back, and that means who is revoked. And so we have reduced revocations significantly. We have put in place, as was required by the statute, a recidivism study, which is somewhat different than revocations. It's a different measure that all of the counties use the same definition, and we use the Juvenile Justice Information System to collect and calculate the data on that. And we have been working since 1996 with the counties on that, and we have seen a 3% decrease in recidivism on that measure. We have established for ourselves a goal of reducing the number of youth leaving OYA who after 5 years are counted in the DOC population. We just have a new baseline established by the Office of Economic Analysis. It's the first year they did this study that shows that after 5 years, 40% of the kids end up in DOC. That seems like a horrifyingly large number. It is actually about equal to our surrounding states' numbers of kids.
Senator Devlin.
Does that number include numbers that are transferred actually from OYA facilities to DOC, or just people who commit new crimes?
Mr. Chair and Senator Devlin, before the study was done, it eliminated the kids that were already in DOC's custody.
Let back up for a moment, Mr. Chair.
Certainly.
I did have a question, actually, for the previous page, very quick.
Okay.
On McLaren, the stated capacity for McLaren later in your presentation is 345. Are we running it at higher than that capacity? Or?
Mr. Chair and Senator Devlin, yes, we are right now.
I think the number I heard was somewhere in the 400s.
We have, as we've gone through the downsizing of the facilities that have just been closed, we have stuffed kids in a higher than stated capacity.
Thank you.
We do have JGIS up and running. We expect Multnomah County to come on by the end of this fiscal year. We have adopted national performance standards and we'll be expanding those to our community-based services. Our hopes are to maintain some of the merging of contracting that we established through Senate Bill 555. We hope to maintain some of our partnerships, which will be difficult under our new management structure, but we hope to maintain them. Just this year, we went online with Victims Information Notification System. We want to maintain our cultural competency efforts in the workforce. We have signed 5 memorandum of agreement with 9 tribes, are on the verge of signing the 6th, and would like to get all of them done. And we have 2 additional goals that we will establish: improving youth offender pro-social skills while reducing antisocial behavior and increasing youth payment of restitution and community service. Our performance measures, we've historically picked
benchmark 62, measuring the measure of juvenile arrests in Oregon, and 65, the measure of new criminal referrals. We link those benchmarks with these performance-based standards that I just spoke about that are part of this national endeavor that we have been part of since the very beginning, and all of our facilities and now our community-based programs are part of. And you can see at the bottom of that list and onto or on that page and onto the next page are the standards that we have chosen to link us to those benchmarks, and I believe that it's important for this committee to sanction those. And I don't know if you have the entire packet in the appendix, if you want to spend some time on that, or if you would like me to go forward.
I think we should keep moving forward.
Okie doke. We'll do it. Pages 10 and 11 show the agency's organizational chart, beginning of 2001-03, and how it is now. Prior to the reductions, we were organized into five areas, and the agency was set up that way. The intent was, and the hope was, that the agency would grow to have a whole continuum of services in each of the five regions. And as you could see from the chart that I reviewed prior, about where we've come since Senate Bill 1, we were not able to achieve that. We have gone from this kind of a regionally based management structure to a much more centralized structure that you see on page 11. And I wanted to spend some time here. There's been a fair amount of controversy about this. We did abolish positions and restructure, and the savings to achieve this organization is $1.3 million. There will be challenges in doing this. For example, we had a meeting last week with the AFSCME union that it represents the field side of our organization, and they asked how we were communicating some of the potential cuts to the judges, who are the ones, of course, who commit the youth to us. And we said, well, we're still figuring out how to do that. Normally, how we would have done that is all of the regional coordinators, the five regional coordinators, meet with the local public safety coordinating councils. The Youth Authority is a statutorily required member, and that's where we would normally provide that kind of information. Under this new structure, we'll have to figure out another kind of way to make those communication and make those kinds of community links, but we will do our best to do that. We're a smaller agency now. We will figure out how to run the agency under a smaller, more streamlined management structure. I wanted also to point out to you that in the new division that was created called Operations, that's where the bulk of the agency's direct services are, under facility programs and community program partnerships. It's where all the supervision of our secure facilities, parole, probation officers is. The program office is a relatively small unit, and what the folks in that unit do, however, is really important to the support of the operations. When we get to the community programs side, you will hear about the community placements that the youth are put in. And more than half of that budget is contracted out to local providers, almost all nonprofit providers, and we manage those contracts out of that office to ensure that the folks who are actually watching those kids on a 24-hour basis are meeting their contractual obligations. This is also where we gather and analyze all the data that are in this book and provide all the responses that you and others have about the youth that are in our care. This is also the part of the agency that provides the necessary training throughout the agency. For example, as a result of the recent suicides, we now provide ongoing regular suicide prevention training to all of the staff in all of our facilities, and they do turn over with some frequency. So that's the kind of work that comes out of that 25-person unit. Flipping the page, moving on to the kind of kids that are in our system, it's very, I think, easy to think about the kids in terms of their criminal activity, which is represented on the left-hand side of the page there. Perhaps less easy to remember that these are also young people, most of whom have very significant problems that have contributed mightily to their criminal behavior. And if you go through this list, you will see that it clearly adds up to way more than 100%, which means most of these kids have more than one of those problems. And Sheila mentioned some of the mental health disorders, and that's many of those kids with mental health problems also have drug and alcohol problems and therefore dropped out of school and got into all kinds of other problems. So that's just an overview of the profile of the overall profile of the youth in the system. The next page, a breakdown by county in case you were interested in the youth from your counties, whether they were juvenile offenders, Measure 11 offenders, or waived. And waived are kids that are convicted of, in adult court of serious offenses but did not get Measure 11 determinate sentences. This does not tell you whether they're in a correctional facility or in a community placement, however.
Karen, can I ask you to, can I get this chart as well with the with the youth population? You've got those for each of the counties.
Which one? I'm sorry, I didn't.
Page 13.
Yes, and you want that?
What I'd like to do is see it with the population. By county youth population.
Oh, okay.
So I can see what the percentages
sure.
are in each level. Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Back up to the waived.
Yes.
Now, is the waived, it could be more than Measure 11 offenses, right? It could be other serious offenses where they were tried in adult court, or is it just Measure 11 offenses where they were tried in adult court? And
Mr. Chair and Senator Devlin, there are other offenses other than the Measure 11 offenses, but also children younger than age 15. Where is Bob? Can be included in the waived offenses.
Thank you.
Moving on, then some of the kind of special populations, female offenders.
Can we stay back on 13 for
sure.
a second? Karen, the reason I asked for population is I think, is it fair to say that some counties utilize the services of OIA more so than other counties necessarily? I mean, it just looks from the raw totals that some counties by population, if you were to compare, have a much higher referral rate than others.
Mr. Chair, that is true. With regard to one segment of the Youth Authority's resources, the beds are divided in, this gets a little bit complex, so try to stay with me here. The beds are divided into three segments, meaning anybody who's convicted on a Measure 11 offense is automatically provided for a bed. Any youth or a waived offense. There's another set of beds that are designated as public safety reserve beds, and those are for non-Measure 11 offenses, generally kids younger who would not have had the opportunity to be convicted, I guess. And any youth who's adjudicated on a public safety reserve offense is automatically given a bed. And that whatever then remains of the total bed count is distributed among the counties on a formula basis that is made. The formula is half of the arrest rate and half of the youth population. And that's an attempt to give every county sort of an equal access to the beds. But that's the only part of the resource that is divided up in any way. Move on. Young women make up about 15% of the total population. They make up even a smaller amount of the closed custody population, from 9 to 10%. They tend to be more acting inward, self-destructive, than acting outward, although there's some evidence across the country and in Oregon that that's changing. Right now, we serve only young women. Well, I should restate that. The closed custody facility at Hillcrest is the only closed custody facility to serve girls and young women. We also serve boys there. The Corvallis House in Corvallis is the transition program for those young women. And we have been targeting improvements in our programs. There's a lot of evidence that the alcohol and drug treatment programs, sort of the standard programs that are offered for boys, are not particularly effective for girls, for example, as well as the typical kind of mental health treatment program. So we have worked with a lot of national folks on trying to improve our programs for the female population, even though it is small. And as the budgets get cut even farther, it is anticipated that the female population will decrease. And perhaps the typical response would be, well, isn't that a good thing? But what that generally means is that the young women in our society go untreated until they've done something really horrendous to themselves, or in the case of some, something really terrible to other people. So it is a concern that these services get very marginalized in decreasing times of dollars. Minority offenders are another special population. Right now, about 25% of the youth authorities population represents minorities. The fastest growing minority population are the Hispanic young people. We have put an emphasis on trying again to have some effect on the minority overrepresentation, not by controlling who comes in the door to us, but by putting in place special programs for kids that transition so that they do not come back to us. And we have had some success in reducing the minority overrepresentation, particularly of African Americans. Clearly, the Youth Authority, like most juvenile justice agencies across the country, is struggling with the special mental health needs, and there is a general recognition across the country that juvenile justice has become kind of the bed of last resort for kids with severe and very significant mental health needs. And as Sheila said, these are not just kids with conduct disorder. They probably all have conduct disorder, but these are kids with diagnosed significant mental health disorders. And not only does it make it difficult to treat them properly with the training that is available for our staff, it also has significant impacts on our budget, because the drug needs for this population is very high and very costly.
and it is all general fund when they are incarcerated. They're not eligible for any federal matching funds. And we put in the appendices a full document of an analysis that we've done on the youth in our facilities, and it's even more shocking if you look at the mental health needs of the young women. As was also mentioned, we have an increasing number of sex offenders in the youth authority's custody, and this is somewhat perplexing in that the sex offender population does quite well when properly supervised on parole and probation. Our statistics show relatively lower rates of recidivism, but it's very difficult to find programs, community-based programs, that will accept these youth. Their insurance, the provider's insurance, forbids them to take the youth. We have had horrendous problems in siting facilities to begin new facilities, and so what we're finding is probably holding more youth in high-cost beds longer than they need to be held, largely because we don't have appropriate places to move them to. But as you can see, the numbers are quite high now. Over 50% of the youth in the facilities have a sex offense on their records. Factors that drive the growth, and again, Sheila talked about this, so I won't go into it too much. In fact, the at-risk population is expected to grow a little bit through 2006, and arrests have been down, though they're starting to bump up again. What this committee, I think, needs to think about, though, is back to this chart, that in terms of the youth authority, when the youth authority is dealing with that small population of the multiple high-end offenders, arrest rate doesn't have that much effect on this population. It has an effect on the overall juvenile justice system, but these are kids that are going to be arrested anyway. Often they're arrested multiple times. What has happened with the youth authority is a couple of things. There's been prevention efforts targeted at local prevention efforts targeted at reaching those kids who were just ready to come into the youth authority's custody, and I think some of those have been successful. And Measure 11 has certainly taken some of those repeat offenders off the streets and locked them up for a very long time. The other thing that has dramatically suppressed the so-called need in the youth authority's budget is, or bed forecast, is that it has been artificially suppressed by budget cutting. And if you flip the page, there's a pretty good example of that. If you look at the bottom half of page 20 of the chart, if you look at the top line, October 2000, and the bottom line, October 2002, the bed forecast that the Office of Economic Analysis does really isn't a bed forecast. It is really a reflection of what the youth authority will need if they just continue current practice, and that can be very manipulated just by cutting the beds out of the budget, as is demonstrated by this chart. If you reduce the bed forecast by 200 kids, you reduce the need by 200 kids, which is what's demonstrated here. So it doesn't truly reduce the need. It just reduces the need as per the forecast that is produced by OEA. So it's and that's due to the fact that the youth authority, unlike Department of Corrections, has paroling authority. So if the budget reduces, we move kids out, and that is reflected in the next forecast. So it's a funny kind of deal. Cost controls, I'll move on to that. We've aggressively utilized video and teleconferencing, as well as telemedicine. We've decreased the number of vehicle incidents, time loss has been reduced. I mentioned our merging of contracts with the Criminal Justice Commission. We've been very aggressive in trying to reduce our health-related costs by negotiating with providers to accept Oregon Medicaid reimbursement rates. And we have worked with Department of Corrections to take advantage of their lower costs for purchasing food. Flipping the page to JGIS, this has been a great success story for, I think, the Youth Authority and the Juvenile Department directors. We have, prior to the development of JGIS, we really couldn't have told you much of anything about the kids in the Youth Authority system or the kids in the county system. And we started from ground zero and built a database that includes all of the kids in Oregon from the time of referral to the time of placement in the Youth Authority and parole. And it is run by a steering committee that's made up of folks who participate in it, primarily the Juvenile Department people and the Oregon Youth Authority, with some secondary partners like the State Police and Department of Education. And it provides statistics, some decision-making information, planning, development, and we are working right now on trying to develop a module that would help us evaluate the kind of programs that we offer kids to determine whether the programs really make a difference. That's the hardest thing we've tackled to date. It is primarily funded by the state, and you will hear... I guess I do that. But you can look on the page 23 and see who the active JGIS users are. We use it throughout the Youth Authority. County detention centers use it. It's accessed by 7 county district attorneys, and county courts use it. We also have a system that lets law enforcement access it if they choose to do that. It is primarily paid for by the state, which is a big piece of what drives the agency's administrative budget. On page 24, you can see all those black dots that tells everything that we do. We develop it, we maintain it, we provide the lines for it, we train people to use it, we operate it. But it is truly a great system. If a police officer picks up a kid in Multnomah County, I shouldn't use Multnomah till June. Okay, I'll start over. They pick up a kid in Clackamas County and deliver him to detention at 1 in the morning. That detention worker can log on and see if that kid has been picked up anywhere else in the state for any reason. If he has a medical allergy, it would have an alert on it. See if he's dangerous, what his prior crimes were. We have a full record of what's gone on with the youth if he ever comes to the Youth Authority, so we know not to try things that haven't been successful with the youth before. It's already been very successful in providing research information.
just very good, workable, kind of down-to-earth system. Page 25, just an overview of the budget. In the governor's budget, we have, we'll be down to 800 beds. Community programs, providing diversion and crime prevention services, residential foster care and individualized services, parole, probation, and program office, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on there because those are all the sections we're going to go through individually.
Okay. Thanks, Karen. I think what we're going to do, I want to make sure that Joanne Fuller and Georgia Stewart have enough time, and I want to get to the priority list. So, Linda, I think I'm going to let them go ahead of you, if that's okay. Mm-hmm. And then we will come back to you if there's time. And
are you going to get to our priority list or your, our joint priority list?
We're going to get, well, we'll do that later on. I have to turn this in today, this list in today, so.
My list I have to turn in today.
So I'd ask Joanne Fuller and Georgia Stewart to come forward. Welcome to the committee. I see you have paperwork and
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Joanne Fuller, and I'm the director of the Department of Community Justice. We're the combined juvenile and adult parole and probation agency in Multnomah County. And it's a pleasure to talk to you today. I want to talk to you primarily about the impact that past funding cuts have had on the juvenile justice system and contemplated cuts into the future. And I've been asked to speak on behalf of Oregon's five most populous counties. So I'm going to talk about Clackamas, Lane, Marion, Washington, and Multnomah. I recognize that in this time of financial constraints, we're going to have to take sacrifices in a lot of different areas that are critical to the functioning of the state and the quality of life in our communities. However, what we're looking at in the juvenile justice system is really potentially crippling the partnership between the states and the counties that has been helping to successfully reduce juvenile crime and, as you heard earlier, impact the recidivism of youth that are brought to us in the system. I want to just touch on a few points. I've given you some written testimony, and I'm not going to read from it. But basically, I want to talk to you about how cuts in the OIA funding have undermined the integrity of our juvenile justice system, and they compromise public safety. OIA is more than institutions, as you were hearing earlier. It is the cornerstone of the state's juvenile justice system. Through OIA's institutions and fundings, you support a variety of functions that help us in the communities to make sure that our communities are safe. That includes the secure beds, it includes shelter and residential beds, it includes the JCP, the Juvenile Crime Prevention Funds, and it includes parole supervision of youth who are returned to the community and need supervision and structure as they return to our communities. Each of these components plays an important role in the criminal justice system, helping to protect the public and hold youth offenders accountable, as well as changing their behavior. Each of these components complements the others and creates balance in our justice system. Together, they ensure that we have a wide range of sanctions and interventions with youth in our community. As you heard earlier, the bulk of youth in the communities never get involved in crime to begin with, as you pointed out, Senator. In addition to that, most youth that are served in the juvenile justice system are served by us at the county level and never come to the state for any services or intervention. But those that do and the programs that are funded in the community by the state for us are vital to making sure that our communities are safe. Large counties depend on OIA institutions, but recent bed cuts have limited our ability to remove dangerous youth from the community. Together, the five most populous counties in Oregon account for over 50% of the new referrals to the juvenile justice system. And in the year 2000, which we did a recidivism, statewide recidivism report that you heard a little bit about earlier, the recidivism rate in those five counties ranged from 31% to 38%. Despite the concentration of juvenile crime in our counties, we've experienced deep cuts in the discretionary beds that we have at OIA. For example, in the last year, Multnomah County's lost 42 beds, Marion County lost 21 beds, and Washington County lost 18 beds. That has the last time our five counties had as few beds as you were looking at earlier was the mid-1980s. Further cuts in OIA diversion and juvenile crime prevention basic funding will dismantle the investment that the state and counties are making in community-based crime prevention services. The OIA diversion and juvenile crime prevention basic funds support a range of community-based programs that are designed to prevent at-risk youth from becoming court-involved or committing offenses that lead to OIA institutionalization. The Governor's Task Force on Juvenile Justice report that preceded Senate Bill 1 called for the building of OIA facilities and investing in community-based services in our communities. As you heard earlier from Karen, that investment in the community never really completely happened. But the JCP basic money and the diversion money really represent the important investment that the state has made in community-based programs as well as the development of institutions. In Multnomah County, those funds support probation supervision, shelter beds, beds in our local juvenile detention facility, residential drug and alcohol treatment, and mental health services. The services in the community are working. In Multnomah County alone, juvenile crime is down by 5% from 2002, and crime in our county is dropping faster than the national average. Between the year 2000 and 2001, juvenile criminal referrals to our department declined by 17%. During that same time period, juvenile crime rose 1.3% nationally. Our recidivism rate has also fallen from 32% in 1997 to 29% in 2001. The cuts we have sustained this year have reduced our services in all of these areas. Now, further reductions in the OIA diversion or JCP basic funding will further jeopardize our ability to provide early intervention and detention services. In Multnomah County, approximately 1,700 youth would lose probation, addiction, mental health treatment, or other services if additional cuts happen to our JCP funding or basic services. Clackamas County will terminate contracts with four treatment programs, reduce eight others, cut beds in detention facilities, and reduce staff. And Marion County will lay off juvenile probation officers and increase caseloads, meaning that there will be less time for those probation officers to intervene with the kids on their caseloads. The proposed cuts to OIA are not cost-effective and in the end will result in higher costs to taxpayers. The cuts to OIA constitute a cost shift to counties. In response to cuts in OIA in this year in shelter and residential beds, some counties are creating their own shelter care. Other counties are holding youth in detention until appropriate and stable residential placement can be arranged. In the end, these cuts do not save Oregon taxpayers money. They simply shift the tax burden to localities from the state. These cuts are eroding the most cost-effective components of the juvenile justice system and the ones that research tell us are going to have the greatest impact in long-term crime in our communities. As a result, taxpayers are going to pay for a system that's less effective and more expensive on a per-offender basis. The juvenile justice system is as critical to public safety as adult corrections, and like the adult system, it depends on a balanced approach with both institutions and community-based interventions. OIA is as critical to public safety as any other part of the public safety system. It provides secure institutions that are really the relief valve for our community when kids get too difficult for us to handle locally. At the same time, the juvenile system is uniquely different than the adult system. Institutionalization is not the most effective response to juvenile crime. In fact, research indicates that incarceration alone does not decrease the risk of criminal behavior. Supervision of a juvenile in the community does not increase the risk of public safety. By addressing criminal behavior early in the lives of youth through effective responses in the community, including probation supervision, alcohol and drug treatment, we can avert future adult criminal activity. Mr. Chairman, earlier you talked about the proper blend of the community balanced with the institutions. I'm really heartened to hear that because for us in the community, that blend is critical to our being able to maintain the safety and effective intervention with youth in our system. And all five of the most populous counties in the state really appreciate the legislature's consideration of that as you move forward to talk more deeply about the OIA budget. Thank you.
Stewart.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Georgia Stewart, and I'm Clatsop County Juvenile Director. My office is located in Astoria, Oregon. I've been employed in the Oregon juvenile justice system for 30 years. Previously, I was a detention worker, a probation officer, and a court services program manager in Jackson County. And currently, I've been in Clatsop County as juvenile director for 4.5 years. In the past 2 years, our juvenile crime, the juvenile crime rate in Clatsop County has been reduced by 26%. This reduction in part is due to the continuum of sanctions and interventions that have been established by the Clatsop County Juvenile Department and the Oregon Youth Authority. The interventions and sanctions hold youth accountable for the criminal behavior, reform the individual, and rehabilitate the delinquent youth. I am here representing rural communities and counties, but I am going to address with you today what the past, by the 2001-2003 biennium impact has been in my particular county. Our discretionary bed commitment to the youth correction facility has been decreased from 7 to 4. The closures of the 4 regional youth correction facilities, one of them was located in Warrenton in my particular county. And what this has done is actually put all of our high-end youth offenders in a centralized location in Salem. They no longer are regionalized, which was the philosophy originally to have the regional facilities. The youth are not working with their parents, and we are not able to invest any local resources in the high-end youth offenders. Young's Bay Detention, which was located at North Coast Youth Correction Facility, was closed. Clatsop, Columbia, and Tillamook County contracted with the Oregon Youth Authority for 14 detention beds. Currently, Clatsop County is sending their youth that need to be detained to Longview, Washington. And that is approximately 70 miles from the location of our Clatsop County. The youth are not able to see their parents on a regular basis. Appropriate youth are not lodged due to the distance and the transportation issues. Public safety is jeopardized because our sheriff's deputies that transport the youth to detention and to court hearings are not remaining on patrol in the community. Probation officers cannot visit youth regularly to develop release plans. Evaluations and assessments are very difficult to arrange, as are prescription renewals. The county also is spending funds outside of the state to provide the detention services. A new 30-day treatment program that was in our detention facility was terminated with the closure of Young's Bay Detention. The program included alcohol and drug treatment and was the only Clatsop County residential program for probation youth. 170 Oregon Youth Authority contracted shelter, residential, and foster care beds were eliminated, and that was out of a total of 760 statewide. In our northwest 7-county area, that included 39 beds. During a 6-month period of time, there would be 56 offenders from the 6 counties that would have been placed in those regional beds. So not only are our youth correctional facility beds being decreased, but our residential foster and shelter care beds were drastically reduced. Clatsop County Oregon Youth Authority Diversion and Juvenile Crime Prevention basic service funding was reduced in my county by $9,700. That may not sound like very much, but that actually was 5% of the biennium funding, and it had to be reduced in the last 4 months. For my county, the reductions in services included alcohol and drug treatment to probation youth, gender-specific girls treatment, cognitive behavior restructuring groups, and community service work crews. And further, in my county, 84 local citizens lost their jobs with the closure of the North Coast Youth Correction Facility. That's huge in a small community. The following is a description of the impact of Clatsop County if further suggested reductions occur in the 2003-2005 biennium budget for the Oregon Youth Authority. With the elimination of the diversion funding, that would reduce the Clatsop County Juvenile Department staffing level by 12%. That 12% does not just include probation officers, it's the juvenile director and my support staff. The response to juvenile crime and probation monitoring service would be seriously impacted. The elimination of the juvenile crime prevention basic service funding would eliminate our department community service work crew supervisor. That supervisor does provide a work crew that is held on Saturdays and Sundays. It's an immediate sanction for youth that have violated their probation or are sentenced to community service. That community service work crew coordinator also supervises a youth conservation corps crew that we have in the summer that's 8 weeks. And that provides daily stipends to 10 of our probation youth that need to pay off restitution to their victims or pay off court fines. Also, there would be an anger management treatment group for our person crime probation youth that would not be funded. Elimination of the remaining 4 discretionary beds at the youth correction facilities for Clatsop County would not allow any offender commitments other than the public safety reserve youth and the Measure 11 youth. Reduction in the Oregon Youth Authority probation parole staff would again place responsibility on county probation staff to supervise an additional 45 youth. There would not be local graduated sanctions to hold repeat offenders, misdemeanor person offenders, or property felony offenders accountable. The county staff currently provides probationary services per probation officer to 50 to 55 youth. The federal recommendation for probationary caseload is 25 to 40, so if we had to take on those additional 45, we would be way out there as far as trying to provide any kind of individual services. The Clatsop County Board of County Commissioners has adopted budget policies that prohibit county general fund dollars from being used to backfill any loss in state shared or federal revenues. The county will not pick up any of the reductions in the state budget. I have been in the Oregon juvenile justice system for 30 years, and I'm heartsick at the imploding of the system with the reductions to the Oregon Youth Authority budget. In 1995, the Oregon Youth Authority was created. I was thrilled to be an individual who, having lived and breathed juvenile justice for 30 years, was part of a response to juvenile crime that was making a difference in juvenile arrests and in juvenile recidivism. Oregon statistics support best practices and the collaboration of local and state partners. We have been doing that. Based on research on what works to impact violent and repeat juvenile offenders, the Oregon juvenile justice system has proven its value and resourcefulness to the public. Clatsop County's response to juvenile offenders will be devastated with further cuts to the funding of the Oregon Youth Authority. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today.
Thank you, Ms. Stewart. I did have a question for the two of you on the blend on how we figure. I mean, I hope we don't have to go here, but should we choose to have to go here? Basically, we have your discretionary beds. We have the juvenile crime prevention grants, which come through the Criminal Justice Commission, and then we have your basic services grants to a great degree, all of which are affecting you, that we have some opportunity, I think. I mean, we have opportunity to move other things around, too. How's the current system working? Are you happy with how it's working with the discretionary beds? Do you think they're being distributed proportionately and equally? I'm trying to get a good sense of where we're at.
Discretionary beds are based on population and juvenile arrest rate. So it seems to be a fair distribution to all the counties. Having a reduction of nearly half my beds in Clatsop County has had a major impact And also having the reductions in the residential shelter and foster care beds has had a major impact too. Discretionary beds, I think, bottom line, that's unique in the Oregon Youth Authority system. We need to have that as a bottom line for our youth offenders. Working with youth offenders, the basic service money and also the diversion money is an absolute in the response in my community to any kind of services that help keep the youth in the community.
I guess my question, the thrust more of my question, though, is if I have to prioritize to a great degree, do we need more diversionary, do we need more discretionary beds? How do we make that balance work? I guess there's a variety of ways to do it. I'm just looking for either a different way to slice it up or some other ideas.
Yeah, and as far as looking at more, as we're looking at more, I guess I haven't thought in those terms. I've thought of looking at what less will do to us. I would like to see us hold firm at this point. Discretionary beds to me are an absolute must. Diversion money, if I had to prioritize, diversion money, basic service money through the JCP plan, and then prevention money. That would be my priority.
Mr. Chair, I would agree with Georgia that the discretionary beds are sort of a floor for us in the community. One of my beliefs that isn't necessarily held by all juvenile directors around the state is that we should be looking at some way of looking at risk as a way to distribute the use of discretionary beds at OYA, maybe creating some baseline that all communities were entitled to, and then taking a look at some way of determining the risk of kids that are sent there, because right now the way that they're distributed creates some anomalies that allows some communities to not be able to place really high-risk kids, like urban communities, for example, where some other communities are able to place kids that are lower risk that may indeed be a problem in their community. But if you weigh them...
Are some communities putting, property offenders into discretionary beds, and you're having, Multnomah County, for example, would have person crime?
That's an example. That's an example of one of the anomalies of the way that they're distributed. Now, I don't think we would ever want to go to an exclusively risk-based system that aced out any county from having discretionary beds at all, because discretionary beds, being able to remove kids from the community into the institution, is such a vital part. I would agree with George's prioritization of the money.
Why don't you give that to us again?
The diversion funds, especially since we all have taken such a big cut in the discretionary beds, and it's really hard to contemplate what the system looks like with an additional cut in discretionary beds, the diversion money becomes more critical than ever, because that's the money that we use to try to manage kids to keep them from needing to go into those beds. Then you have the JCP basic money. Again, that's funding a basic kinds of services in the community, things like shelter care, things like detention, things like probation and parole, which again allows us to try to keep kids from needing to go to OYA. And then the JCP prevention money, which clearly the report says has been very effective at addressing the delinquency, the future involvement in the juvenile justice system of the kids that are involved in it. But if you have to look at priorities, I think what we're trying to do is preserve our capacity to work with the most serious kids in the community.
And I guess that's my next question, though, is if the world is held whole to some extent, do we need to shift some of those resources around? Would you rather see us switch to JCP prevention grants to give you more discretionary beds? I'm trying to see within the realm of the OYA juvenile directors. Nobody wants to lose money anywhere, and I know that these are affecting also your bottom line budgets at the local level, but by the same token, we have to, you saw the list probably that got handed out. It's not a pretty picture, and we obviously want to prevent the worst offenders from reoffending if we can do that. And I know that there are some blend, but is there a need for us to shift some resources, either to put more discretionary beds, do more base dollar kinds of things, and eliminate the crime prevention? I mean, I don't want to have to do that, but that's the question that the committee's having to ask.
We had a discussion with a couple other juvenile directors. That's why George and I are smiling at each other, because we had this discussion the other day about what to do. And I think that at least the juvenile directors that I've talked to feel like the basic and the diversion money is critical enough that if shifts had to be made, they would rather give up JCP prevention money in order to preserve discretionary beds, diversion money, and basic money. The other thing, I guess, that I would...
So then my question is, if I have to do prevention, if I have to eliminate some of the prevention things or shift the funds, who do I shift it to? Do I shift it back to OYA to do discretionary beds, or do I shift it down to the counties to do basic grants and services?
You might get different answers from each county about that, to tell you the honest truth.
That all the time.
Right. I think that what we would say is, if we could keep the discretionary from Multnomah County, just speaking from Multnomah County, if we could keep the discretionary beds that we had today, and we were able to keep our diversion and our basic money, and we had to take cuts in JCP prevention, that would probably be that's probably what we would want to do. I don't think we would want to see cuts in diversion or basic in order to increase the beds at OYA, because we're trying to have the balance. Did that make sense?
But with the prevention money.
Yes. Yes. What would you
if
do?
If I was to move
it?
The prevention. Yeah. Do you want me to keep the prevention money where it's at, or do you want me to shift it? And if I shift it, do I shift it to basic service grants, or do we shift it to, well, basic service
right.
diversion grants, or do I switch it to, discretionary?
It's a hard question, and I know it's the question you guys
have.
That's
why I don't want.
Right.
That's why we're asking you.
Right. Right.
Oh, you have an option.
I think.
I mean.
I think
I got them on the stick, so I'm trying to.
I do think that that's a really difficult question. I would shift it to basic and diversion. There's so many responsibilities that are being shifted to the county level at this point due to the reductions for the Oregon Youth Authority funding, and we have got to be able to sustain services in our county at this point to be able to fill that gap. You know, and we've centralized at this time. It's a horrible thing to have to do, but it's already been done. So if we can, you know, build up basic and diversion money, I feel that that's where we need to go.
The Hanson option.
Okay, and that would be to lump all the funding together, right. Allocate it to the counties, and say, spend it for what you think is most appropriate to meet your needs.
The only problem with that is you have to keep, OYA has to have some predictor of how many beds they have to keep open and the size and scale.
Well, I mean, it obviously have to be a process that worked out that people could plan on, and there'd have to be a commitment that it couldn't vary halfway through a biennium or... But in terms
of like the 1145 money, everyone's trying. 1145, everyone's giving it back to us now. So.
Well, that the state's credibility at maintaining funding is somewhat sometimes not terribly consistent. But
Mr. Chair,
but it would seem to me that there's going to be incredible variations between the different needs of the state. For example, the use of the diversion beds. There's inequities. I think maybe one of the things that would drive that would be rural Oregon might have a lot fewer options. Anyway.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, one of the other things that we have talked about is the possibility that different counties could purchase, if you want to call it that, beds with OYA, with local money, if there was money that was sent to counties to be discretionary, it would have to be a purchase for the whole biennium, and you'd have to purchase enough, there'd have to be enough units that were purchased that OYA could plan and be cost efficient in their use of the facilities and all that stuff. But that is something that we've talked about, because for some counties, the discretionary beds are the critical thing, and other counties agree with Georgia and myself that we need the investment in the dollars locally, and we think we can deliver the services locally. One other thing I wanted to say on this point is, if the JCP prevention money was cut significantly but not eliminated, I think we'd need to take a look at the scope of what that money is supposed to do and the outcomes that are attached to it and all of that, because those are very broad. And if that money got halved, I think that the state and the counties would want to really focus that money in a particular way.
Okay.
Further questions? We appreciate you both being here. Thank you.
Thank you.
With that, we're going to continue over the remainder of this hearing on House Bill 5058. We're going to close the public hearing and continue it over until tomorrow. Doug's back. We've got the priority list, and I just wanted to go through any final comments that people had. My understanding is I get to go in with the co-chairs at 3 o'clock on this list. So, Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have to leave at 3 also, so I'll get my comment on the record.
All right.
I have discussed an item with a couple of members of the Senate, and they do have some concerns, although I know that it probably will not be moved up. They do have some concerns with the OYA ranking for the special funding for Multnomah and Deschutes County gang task forces. But also understanding that in this matrix, if I could get it up, moved up to a 7 or 8, that may not be high enough to get it funding.
Okay. Noted for the record, Senator Devlin. I certainly appreciate it. Representative Hansen.
Well, I certainly concur with Senator Devlin.
Are you concurring with me?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Anyone see anything? I tried to change some of the things around. Some of them I looked at your comments and went back and rethought. Some of them I changed. Some of them I didn't. And if anyone wants to ask about those, I'm happy to respond for the record so people understand where and how things were moved around a little bit.
Mr. Chairman, I also wanted to comment, too, that I agree with your... you added a couple of items that I thought were important to add in terms of the matrix, and one was the funding of the courts at an adequate level for operations, which wasn't part of the original, and also the funding for the shortfall in 1145 funds in terms of trying to forestall more counties from leaving the 1145 program.
Okay.
Because once they leave the program, then their charges become our problem.
Yes. Other comments on the list, numbers, anything else? All right. With that, that was easy. We're done.